Hi there, and welcome to the Cory Doctorow podcast. I'm Cory Doctorow, coming back to you with yet another part of Bruce Sterling's magnificent history of the hacker movement and the early days of law enforcement on the internet, The Hacker Crackdown, read by permission of the author and the first piece of literary freeware. I'm getting on a plane for Amsterdam in a few hours. I'm here in London, having finally rid my life of boxes and gotten partially settled in, and now I'm off to speak at the conference picnic, and from there I go to speak, teach the Viable Paradise workshop, and then I'm going to give a speech at a private event in South Carolina, and another one in, San Francisco. And I've got some meetings in New York, and basically no time to socialize, no time to do anything fun. It's just get on a plane, get off a plane, give a speech, get on a plane, get off a plane, give a speech. For the next 2.5 weeks, I'm going to take my headset along and try and keep this podcast up. We'll see how well that goes. And then I'll be back in London and settle down-ish. My parents are coming to visit, and life should be good-ish. I am settling back down here in London. Things are nice. My jet lag is pretty much done, I'm enjoying it quite a lot, especially the public transit and all the walking. Gosh, it's been really nice to get walking again. And as I say, the boxes are finally out of my life. I've managed to trim everything down to, there's two boxes left in my office here, one for a set of speakers I bought and one for a printer I bought, both of which I'm going to get rid of soon. And then that will be it. That will be all of my boxes gone from my life, either in storage or somewhere else. There is actually one box visible from where I sit here in my office, and that's the box of page proofs for Little Brother, my next novel. I just got a box of bound galleys for it, and gosh, am I excited, because it means that it's almost a book. It's like seeing an ultrasound of a baby that's on the way or something. It's pretty spectacular. So, very, very, very happy about this, and can't wait for the book to come. Early blurbs from people who read it beforehand that are printed in the book are incredibly kind and lead me to believe that I might actually have something that people want to read here. I hope that turns out to be the case. My publisher is certainly very happy about it. They think I've got a real winner here. And I've just gotten off the phone with the U.S. Embassy here in London to find out what I need to do to go on my book tour in May. I may be coming to a city near you this May, and I hope that you'll turn out and see me and say hello. It would be great to meet more of you. I always love running into podcast listeners when I give these face-to-face things. Anyway, that's enough maundering. Let's read Bruce's book for a while do it the justice it deserves, I hope. But now Leftist was pat searched for weapons by grim professionals, and his bag of floppies was quickly seized. He and his parents were all shepherded into separate rooms and grilled at length as a score of officers secured their home for anything electronic. Leftist was horrified as his treasured IBM AT personal computer with its 40 meg of hard disk and his recently purchased 8386 IBM clone with a whopping 100 meg hard disk both went swiftly out the door into Secret Service custody. They also seized all his disks, all his notebooks, and a tremendous booty in dog-eared telco documents that Leftist had snitched out of telco dumpsters. Leftist figured the whole thing for a big misunderstanding. He'd never been into military computers. He wasn't a spy or a communist. He was just a good old Georgia hacker. And now he just wanted all these people out of the house. But it seemed they wouldn't go until he made some kind of statement. And so he leveled with them. And that, Leftist said later, from his federal prison camp in Talladega, Alabama, was a big mistake. The Atlanta area was unique in that it had three members of the Legion of Doom who actually occupied more or less the same physical locality. Unlike the rest of LOD, who tended to associate by phone and computer, Atlanta LOD actually were tightly knit. It was no real surprise that the Secret Service agents apprehending Ervil at the computer labs at Georgia Tech would discover profit with him as well. Ervil, a 21-year-old Georgia Tech student in polymer chemistry, posed quite a puzzling case for law enforcement. Ervil, also known as Necron 99, as well as other handles, for he tended to change his cover alias about once a month, was both an accomplished hacker and a fanatic simulation gamer. Simulation games are an unusual hobby, but then hackers are unusual people, and their favorite pastimes tend to be somewhat out of the ordinary. The best-known American simulation game is probably Dungeons & Dragons, a favorite multiplayer parlor entertainment played with paper, maps, pencils, and statistical tables and a variety of oddly shaped dice. Players pretend to be heroic characters exploring a wholly invented fantasy world. The fantasy world of simulation gaming are commonly pseudo-medieval, involving swords and sorcery, spellcasting wizards, knights in armor, unicorns and dragons, demons, and goblins. Urville and his fellow gamers preferred their fantasies highly technological. They made use of a game known as GURPS, the generic universal role-playing system published by a company called Steve Jackson Games, or SJG. GURPS served as a framework for creating a wide variety of artificial fantasy worlds. Steve Jackson Games published a smorgasbord of books full of detailed information and gaming hints, which were used to flesh out many different fantastic backgrounds for the basic GURPS framework. Urville made extensive use of two SJG books called GURPS High Tech and GURPS Special Ops. In the artificial fantasy world of GURPS Special Ops, players entered a modern fantasy of intrigue and international espionage. On beginning the game, players started small and powerless, perhaps as minor league CIA agents or penny ante arms dealers. But as players persisted through a series of game sessions generally lasted for hours, over long, elaborate campaigns that might be pursued for months on end, then they would achieve new skills, new knowledge, and new power. They would acquire and hone new abilities, such as marksmanship, karate, wiretapping, or Watergate burglary. They could also win various kinds of imaginary booty, like Berettas, or martini shakers, or fast cars with ejection seats and machine guns under the headlights. As might be imagined from the complexity of these games, Urville's gaming notes were very detailed and extensive. Urville was a dungeon master, inventing scenarios for his fellow gamers, giant simulated adventure puzzles for his friends to unravel. Urville's game notes covered dozens of pages with all sorts of exotic lunacy, all about ninja raids on Libya and break-ins on encrypted red Chinese supercomputers. His notes were written on scrap paper and kept in loose-leaf binders. The handiest scrap paper around Urville's college digs were the many pounds of Bell South printouts and documents he had snitched out of telco dumpsters. His notes were written on the back of misappropriated telco property. Worse yet, the gaming notes were chaotically interspersed with Urville's hand-scrawled records involving actual computer intrusions that he had committed. Not only was it next to impossible to tell Urville's fantasy game notes from cyberspace reality, but Urville himself barely made this distinction. It's no exaggeration to say that to Urville, it was all a game. Urville was very bright, highly imaginative, and quite careless of other people's notions of propriety. His connection to reality was not something to which he paid a great deal of attention. Hacking was a game for Urville. It was an amusement that he carried out. It was something that he was doing for fun. And Urville was an obsessive young man. He could no more stop hacking than he could stop in the middle of a jigsaw puzzle or stop in the middle of reading a Stephen Donaldson fantasy trilogy. The name Urville came from a best-selling Donaldson novel. Urville's airy, bulletproof attitude seriously annoyed his interrogators. First of all, he didn't consider that he'd done anything wrong. There was scarcely a shred of honest remorse in him. On the contrary, he seemed privately convinced that his police interrogators were operating in a demented fantasy world all their own. Urville was too polite and well-behaved to say this straight out, but his reactions were askew and disquieting. For instance, there was the business about the LOD's ability to monitor phone calls to the police and Secret Service. Urville agreed that this was quite possible and posed no big problem for LOD. In fact, he and his friends had kicked the idea around on the black ice boards, much as they had discussed many other nifty notions, such as building personal flamethrowers and jury-rigging fistfuls of blasting caps. They had hundreds of dial-up numbers for government agencies that they'd gotten through scanning the Atlanta phones or had pulled from rated VAX VMS mainframes. Basically, they'd never gotten around to listening in on the cops because the idea wasn't interesting enough to begin with. Besides, if they'd been monitoring Secret Service phone calls, obviously they'd never have been caught in the first place, right? The Secret Service was less than satisfied with his rapier-like hacker logic. Then there was the issue of crashing the phone system. No problem, Urville admitted sunnily. Atlanta LOD could have shut down phone service all over Atlanta any time they liked. Even the 911 service? Oh, nothing special about that, Ervil explained patiently. Bring the switch to its knees, with, say, the Unix makedir bug, and 911 goes down too, as a matter of course. The 911 system wasn't very interesting, frankly. It might be tremendously interesting to cops, for odd reasons of their own, but as technical challenges went, the 911 service was Yawnsville. So, of course, the Atlanta 3 could crash service. They probably could have crashed service all over Bell South territory, if they'd worked at it for a while. But LOD weren't crashers. Only losers and rodents were crashers. The LOD were elite. Ervil was privately convinced that the sheer technical expertise could win him free of any kind of problem. As far as he was concerned, elite status in the digital underground had placed him permanently beyond the intellectual grasp of cops and straights. Ervil had a lot to learn. Of the three LOD stalwarts, Prophet was in the most direct trouble. Prophet was a Unix programming expert who burrowed in and out of the internet as a matter of course. He started his hacking career at around age 14, meddling with the Unix mainframe system at the University of North Carolina. Prophet himself had written the handy Legion of Doom file Unix Use and Security from the ground up. Unix, pronounced Unix, is a powerful, flexible computer operating system for multi-user, multitasking computers. In 1969, when Unix was created at Bell Labs, such computers were exclusive to large corporations and universities. But today, Unix is run on thousands of powerful home machines. Unix was particularly well-suited to telecommunications programming and had become a standard in the field. Naturally, Unix also became a standard for the elite hacker and phone freak. Lately, Prophet had not been as active as Leftist and Ervil, but Prophet was a recidivist. In 1986, when he was 18, Prophet had been convicted of unauthorized access to a computer network in North Carolina. He'd been discovered breaking into the Southern Bell Data Network, a Unix-based internal telco network supposedly closed to the public. He'd gotten a typical hacker sentence, 6 months suspended, 120 hours community service, and 3 years probation. After that humiliating bust, Prophet had gotten rid of most of his tonnage of illicit freak and hacker data, and had tried to go straight. He was, after all, still on probation. But by the autumn of 1988, the temptations of cyberspace had proved too much for young Prophet, and he was shoulder to shoulder with Ervil and Leftist in some of the hairiest systems around. In early September 1988, he'd broken into Bell South's centralized automation system, AMSX, or Advanced Information Management System. AMSX was an internal business network for Bell South, where telco employees stored electronic mail, databases, memos, and calendars, and did text processing. Since AMSX did not have public dial-ups, it was considered utterly invisible to the public and was not well secured. It didn't even require passwords. Prophet abused an account known as WAA1, the personal account of an unsuspecting telco employee. Disguised as the real owner of WAA1, Prophet made about 10 visits to AMSX. Prophet did not damage or delete anything in the system. His presence in AMSX was harmless and almost invisible, but he could not rest content with that. One particular piece of processed text on AMSX was a telco document known as the Bell South Standard Practice 660-225-104SV Control Office Administration of Enhanced 911 Services for Special Services and Major Account Centers dated March 1988. Prophet had not been looking for this document. It was merely one among hundreds of similar documents with impenetrable titles. However, having blundered over it in the course of his illicit wanderings through AMSX, he decided to take it with him as a trophy. It might prove very useful in some future bragging, boasting, and strutting session. So, sometime in September 1988, Prophet ordered the AMSX computer to copy this document, henceforth simply called the E911 document, and transfer this copy to his home computer. No one noticed that Prophet had done this. He had stolen the E911 document in some sense, but notions of property in cyberspace can be tricky. Bell South noticed nothing wrong, because Bell South still had their original copy. They had not been robbed of the document itself. Many people were supposed to copy this document, specifically people who worked for the 19 Bell South Special Services and Major Account Centers, scattered through the southeastern United States. That was what it was for, why it was present on a computer network in the first place, so that it could be copied and read by telco employees. But now the data had been copied by someone who wasn't supposed to look at it. Prophet now had his trophy, but he further decided to store yet another copy of the E911 document on another person's computer. This unwitting person was a computer enthusiast named Richard Andrews, who lived near Joliet, Illinois. Richard Andrews was a Unix programmer by trade and ran a powerful Unix board called JolNet in the basement of his house. Prophet, using the handle Robert Johnson, had obtained an account on Richard Andrews' computer, and there he stashed the E911 document by storing it in his own personal section of Andrews' computer. Why did Prophet do this? If Prophet had eliminated the E911 document from his own computer and kept it hundreds of miles away on another machine under an alias, he might have been fairly safe from discovery and prosecution, although his sneaky action had certainly put the unsuspecting Richard Andrews at risk. But, like most hackers, Prophet was a pack rat for illicit data. When it came to the crunch, he could not bear to part from his trophy. When Prophet's place in Decatur, Georgia, was raided in July 1989, there was the E911 document, a smoking gun. And there was Prophet in the hands of the Secret Service, doing his best to explain. Our story now takes us away from the Atlanta 3 and their raids of the summer of 1989. We must leave the Atlanta 3 cooperating fully with their numerous investigators, and all three of them did cooperate, as their sentencing memorandum from the U.S. District Court in the Northern Division of Georgia explained, just before all three of them were sentenced to various federal prisons in November 1990. We must now catch up on the other aspects of the War on the Legion of Doom. The War on the Legion was a war on a network, in fact, a network of three networks, which intertwined and interrelated in a complex fashion. The Legion itself, with the Atlanta LOD and their hanger-on Fry Guy, were the first network. The second network was Frack Magazine, with its editors and contributors. The third network involved the electric circle around a hacker known as Terminus. The investigation of Terminus involved a great deal of The war against these hacker networks was carried out by a law enforcement network. Atlanta LOD and Fry Guy were pursued by USSS agents and federal prosecutors in Atlanta, Indiana, and Chicago. Terminus found himself pursued by USSS and federal prosecutors from Baltimore and Chicago. And the war against Frack was almost entirely a Chicago operation. The investigation of Terminus involved a great deal of energy, mostly from the Chicago task force, but it was to be the least known and least publicized of the crackdown operations. Terminus, who lived in Maryland, was a Unix programmer and consultant, fairly well known under his given name in the Unix community, and an acknowledged expert on AT&T's minicomputers. Terminus idolized AT&T, especially Bellcore, and longed for public recognition as a Unix expert. His highest ambition was to work for Bell Labs. But Terminus had odd friends and a spotted history. Terminus had once been the subject of an admiring interview in Frack, Volume 2, Issue 14, File 2, dated May 1987. In this article, Frack co-editor Taryn King described Terminus as an electronics engineer, 5'9", brown-haired, born in 1959, at 28 years old, quite mature for a hacker. Terminus had once been the sysop of a freak hack underground board called MetroNet, which ran on an Apple II. Later, he'd replaced MetroNet with an underground board called MegaNet, specializing in IBMs. In his younger day, Terminus had written one of the very first and most elegant code scanning programs for the IBM PC. This program had been widely distributed in the underground. Uncounted legions of PC-owning freaks and hackers had used Terminus's scanner to rip off telco codes. This feat had not escaped the attention of telco security. It hardly could, since Terminus's earlier handle, Terminal Technician, was proudly written on the program. When he became a full-time computer professional, specializing in telecommunications programming, he adopted the handle Terminus, meant to indicate that he had reached the final point of being a proficient hacker. He'd moved up to the Unix-based NetSys board on an AT&T computer with four phone lines and an impressive 240 megs of storage. NetSys carried complete issues of Frack, and Terminus was quite friendly with its publishers, Taryn King and Night Lightning. In the early 1980s, Terminus had been a regular on PloverNet, Pirate 80, Sherwood Forest, and Shadowland, all well-known pirate boards, all heavily frequented by the Legion of Doom. As it happened, Terminus was never officially in LOD, because he'd never been given the official LOD high sign and backslap by Legion Maven Lex Luthor. Terminus had never physically met anyone from LOD, but that scarcely mattered much. The Atlanta Three themselves had never been officially vetted by Lex either. As far as law enforcement was concerned, the issues were clear. Terminus was a full-time adult computer professional with particular skills at AT&T software and hardware. But Terminus reeked of the Legion of Doom and the Underground. On February 1, 1990, half a month after the Martin Luther King Day crash, USSS agents Tim Foley from Chicago and Jack Lewis from the Baltimore office, accompanied by AT&T security officer Jerry Dalton, traveled to Middletown, Maryland. There they grilled Terminus at his home, to the stark terror of his wife and small children, and, in their customary fashion, hauled his computers out the door. The Netsis machine proved to contain a plethora of arcane Unix software, proprietary source code formerly owned by AT&T, software such as Unix System 5 Release 3.2, Unix SV Release 3.1, UUCP communication software, Corn Shell, RFS, IWB, WWB, DWB, the C++ programming language, PMON, Toolchest, Quest, DACT, and SFIND. In the long-established piratical traditions of the underground, Terminus had been trading this illicitly copied software with a small circle of friendly Unix programmers. Very unwisely, he had stored 7 years of his electronic mail on his Netsis machine, which documented all the friendly arrangements he had made with his various colleagues. Terminus had not crashed the AT&T phone system on January 15th. He was, however, blithely running a not-for-profit AT&T software piracy ring. This was not an activity AT&T found amusing. AT&T security officer Jerry Dalton valued this stolen property at over $300,000. AT&T's entry into the tussle of free enterprise had been complicated by the new, vague ground rules of the information economy. Until the breakup of Ma Bell, AT&T was forbidden to sell computer hardware or software. Ma Bell was the phone company. Ma Bell was not allowed to use this enormous revenue from telephone utilities in order to finance any entry into the computer market. AT&T nevertheless invented the Unix operating system, and somehow AT&T managed to make Unix a minor source of income. Weirdly, Unix was not sold as computer software, but actually retailed under an obscure regulatory exemption allowing sales of surplus equipment and scrap. Any bolder attempt to promote or retail Unix would have aroused angry legal opposition from computer companies. Instead, Unix was licensed to universities at modest rates, where the acids of academic freedom ate away steadily at AT&T's proprietary rights. Come the breakup, AT&T recognized that Unix was a potential gold mine. By now, large chunks of Unix code had been created that were not AT&T's and were being sold by others. An entire rival Unix-based operating system had arisen in Berkeley, California, one of the world's great founts of ideological hackerdom. Today, hackers commonly considered Berkeley Unix to be technically superior to AT&T's System V Unix, but AT&T had not allowed mere technical elegance to intrude on the real-world business of marketing proprietary software. AT&T has made its own code deliberately incompatible with other folks' Unix, and has written code so that it can prove is copyrightable, even if that code happens to be somewhat awkward or kludgy. AT&T user licenses are serious business agreements, replete with very clear copyright statements and non-disclosure clauses. AT&T has not exactly kept the Unix cat in the bag, but it kept a grip on its scruff with some success. By the rampant explosive standards of software piracy, AT&T Unix source code is heavily copyrighted, well-guarded, well-licensed. Unix was traditionally run only on mainframe machines owned by large groups of suit and tie professionals, rather than on bedroom machines where people can get up to easy mischief. And AT&T Unix source code is serious high-level programming. The number of skilled Unix programmers with any actual motive to swipe Unix source code is small. It's tiny compared to the tens of thousands prepared to rip off, say, entertaining PC games like Leisure Suit Larry. But by 1989, the Where's Dude Underground in the persons of Terminus and his friends were gnawing at AT&T Unix, and the property in question was not sold for $20 over the counter at the local branch of Babbage's or Egghead's. This was massive, sophisticated, multi-line, multi-author corporate code worth tens of thousands of dollars. It must be recognized at this point that Terminus's purported ring of Unix software pirates had not actually made any money from their suspected crimes. The $300,000 figure bandied about for the contents of Terminus's computer did not mean that Terminus was in possession, actual illicit possession, of $300,000 of AT&T's dollars. Terminus was shipping software back and forth privately, person to person, for free. He was not making a commercial business of piracy. He hadn't asked for money. He didn't take money. He lived quite modestly. AT&T employees, as well as freelance Unix consultants like Terminus, commonly worked with proprietary AT&T software, both in the office and at home on their private machines. AT&T rarely sent security officers out to comb the hard drive of its consultants. Cheap freelance Unix contractors were quite useful to AT&T. They didn't have health insurance or retirement programs, much less union membership in the Communications Workers of America. They were humble digital drudges, wandering with mop and bucket through the great technological temple of AT&T. But when the Secret Service arrived at their homes, it seemed they were eating with company silverware and sleeping on company sheets. Outrageously, they behaved as if the things they worked with every day belonged to them. And these were no mere hacker teenagers with their hands full of trash paper and their noses pressed to the corporate window pane. These guys were Unix wizards, not only carrying AT&T data in their machines and their heads, but eagerly networking about it over machines that were far more powerful than anything previously imagined in private hands. How do you keep people disposable, yet assure their awestruck respect for your property? It was a dilemma. Much Unix code was public domain, available for free. Much proprietary Unix code had been extensively rewritten, perhaps altered so much that it became an entirely new product, or perhaps not. Intellectual property rights for software developers were and are extraordinarily complex and confused. And software piracy, like the private copying of videos, is one of the most widely practiced crimes in the world today. The USSS were not experts in Unix or familiar with the customs of its use. The United States Secret Service, considered as a body, did not have one single person in it who could program in a Unix environment. No, not even one. The Secret Service were making extensive use of expert help, but the experts they had chosen were AT&T and Bell Corp security officials, the very victims of the purported crime under investigation, the very people whose interest in AT&T's proprietary software was most pronounced. On February 6, 1990, Terminus was arrested by Agent Lewis. Eventually, Terminus would be sent to prison for his illicit use of a piece of AT&T software. The issue of pirated AT&T software would bubble along in the background during the war on the Legion of Doom. Some half-dozen of Terminus's online acquaintances, including people in Illinois, Texas, and California, were grilled by the Secret Service in connection with the illicit copying of software. Except for Terminus, however, none were charged with a crime. None of them shared his peculiar prominence in the hacker underground. But that did not mean that these people would or could stay out of trouble. The transferal of illicit data in cyberspace is hazy and ill-defined business, with paradoxical dangers for everyone concerned. Hackers, signal carriers, board owners, cops, prosecutors, even random passers-by. Sometimes well-meant attempts to avert trouble or punish wrongdoing bring more trouble than would simple ignorance, indifference, or impropriety. Terminus's Netsys board was not a common or garden bulletin board system, though it had most of the usual functions of a board. Netsys was not a standalone machine, but part of the globe-spanning UUCP cooperative network. The UUCP network uses a set of Unix software programs called Unix to Unix Copy, which allows Unix systems to throw data to one another at high speeds through the public telephone network. UUCP is radically decentralized, not-for-profit, a network of Unix computers. There are tens of thousands of these Unix machines. Some are small, but many are powerful, and also linked to other networks. UUCP has certain arcane links to major networks such as JANET, EZNET, BitNet, JUNET, VNET, DASNET, PeaceNet, and FidoNet, as well as the gigantic Internet. The so-called internet is not actually a network itself, but rather an internetwork of connections standard, an internetwork connection standards that were that allow several globe-spanning computer networks to communicate with one another. Readers fascinated by the weird and intricate tangles of modern computer networks may enjoy John S. Quartermain's authoritative 719-page explication, The